You are now listening to Macrodose.
Hello and welcome to Macrodose, a podcast hosted by me, James Meadway, that brings you your weekly fix of everything economics in a quick 15-minute roundup. Each Wednesday morning, we bring you the key stories making the news and the analysis you need to make sense of them. On today's episode, we'll take a look at, first, as the news that the UK has entered a recession grabs headlines, we'll ask whether there's more to this story than meets the eye, or perhaps rather less. Second, we'll be taking a look at the truly incredible amount of energy that the digital economy requires to keep ticking over, and its likely geopolitical consequences. And our third story concerns the apparent return of inflation, and how it never really went away, and perhaps never really will. Our first story this week is the news that the UK dipped into recession at the end of last year, provoking a great deal of excitable commentary, not least from the opposition Labour Party, who have been insisting that things can only get better once they're in government. Just to be clear on what all of this means, and cutting through the noise a bit, saying the UK is in a recession is saying that two consecutive quarters last year, GDP, or gross domestic product, in the UK fell. So between July and September last year, GDP fell 0.1%. Between October and December, it fell 0.3%. And that's it. That's what the fuss is about. There are two reasons that this is not quite as big a story as is being made out. The first is that the UK economy has been stagnating for well over a decade, really since the introduction of austerity spending cuts by the coalition government in 2010. Most developed world economies have not done especially well in the last 15 years or so, with a combination of austerity in the 2010s and rising costs in the 2020s, particularly energy costs, dragging back on demand. As mentioned a few weeks back, the one exception to this trend has been the US, not only because it has mostly avoided the kind of austerity seen in Europe, but also because it is now the world's biggest producer of fossil fuels thanks to the shale revolution, meaning it has not been so badly affected by energy price surges across the world. But the UK has been notably bad on this front for a long period of time, with productivity growth in particular being very low in comparison to pre-2008 standards. Productivity growth basically refers to increases in how much output or value is created by each person for every hour worked. And if we consider that this was the basic motor of capitalist growth for 200 years, we can see that for Britain to stagnate like this is unusual. Again, this has been a trend across the developed world, but Britain is still an outlier here. The quickest explanation is that it just has very low rates of investment. As we flagged last week, the UK has had the lowest investment of any G7 country in almost every year for the last three decades. And that's not just government investment, that's also private businesses failing to spend on new equipment or buildings or research, especially in the last decade. As past investments age, they get less productive. Things fall apart over time. So unless you have new investments, productivity will tend to fall behind. Notice, incidentally, that this has almost nothing to do with the government's preferred explanation for low productivity, which is essentially that people have just become too lazy. They don't work hard enough or long enough, and so the economy won't grow. There are more people out of work now than before COVID, but it's not due to a spontaneous outbreak of laziness. It's the direct effects of COVID itself, with an estimated 2 million people having been affected by long COVID in the UK so far, and an ageing and increasingly sickly population. It's why life expectancy has actually fallen in the last few years. A better explanation for this low productivity is that businesses have been stashing away money in their bank accounts instead of investing it. There is now over £900 billion hoarded uselessly in UK company bank accounts. That's money that's sitting there doing absolutely nothing instead of being put to useful work. So the context of this relatively minor recession is that in reality, things have been rubbish for a long period of time in the UK. Whether we drift in or out of recession as technically defined matters less than that long-term picture. Which gets me on to the second reason this isn't as big a story as presented. A recession is defined as two consecutive quarters of falling GDP. Now, GDP is just a number, scraped together by economists, that is meant to indicate how much economic activity is taking place in a particular country. But it's not necessarily a very helpful metric, and increasingly it's an unreliable guide to what is happening in an economy. It excludes, for example, the essential house and care work that is most often still performed by women, and without which the economy would collapse. Since such work is not typically paid for, it doesn't get registered by GDP. It also doesn't consider environmental damage. If you cut down an entire forest to dig oil wells, this is actually a massive boost to GDP. The loss of trees and the greenhouse gases from the oil products simply don't count. But what's been happening recently is that GDP is becoming detached from other, typically more immediately relevant figures. It used to act as a good guide to what is happening in the economy generally. Increasing GDP typically meant real wages would rise and lots of jobs would be created. Most people would typically feel, and actually would be, somewhat better off. But again, since about 2010, we've seen GDP rise, if rather slowly, whilst real wages have actually fallen. Most people feel, and typically actually are, somewhat worse off than a few years ago. This disconnection works the other way too. Right now, headline inflation has come down and unemployment is low, so workers are more able to bargain for better pay. Real wages in Britain are actually rising after having fallen sharply in the last few years. But GDP is in fact going the other way at the minute. These two numbers don't align. There are many reasons for this. My old macroeconomics lecturer, Charles Bean, wrote a very useful review of problems with official economics statistics back in 2017. The primary one he listed is that the digital economy in particular is really hard to measure. If you watch a video on YouTube, you typically don't pay for it, but it's clearly economic output of some kind. After all, someone made the video and you're consuming it. But because it's not directly paid for, it's hard to work out what actual contribution to GDP was made here, or even who made it. Was it whoever produced and uploaded the video, who might be in the UK or anywhere else in the world? Or was it YouTube, who are based somewhat for tax purposes, in Ireland? So over time, as more activity moves online, GDP is getting increasingly divorced from the economic activity it claims to measure. And since it was always a sexist measure, missing out on all that unpaid care work typically performed by women, and since it ignores environmental costs, there's a very good case for retiring it entirely and instead focusing on more useful indicators, real household incomes being a good place to start, for example. More specifically, these difficulties in measuring GDP have meant that, like other economic statistics, the number is becoming more approximate over time. It keeps getting revised, and last week's number was just the first estimate for the last quarter of last year. New estimates can change the picture quite drastically. In 2012, for example, the UK was also initially registered as having a recession, straight after the recession of the financial crisis. However, subsequent revisions to the estimates for GDP turned this supposed recession into a period of growth. We saw similar effects during COVID, when GDP became very unreliable as the economy was shut down. I wouldn't be too surprised if this mild recession in 2023 goes the same way, with future revisions to the data pulling GDP numbers up and reporting instead continuous, if slow, economic growth. Above all else, these statistical shenanigans should remind us that the figures which get reported on the economy aren't necessarily the ones that really matter. GDP increasingly has less to do with how people live their lives and little to do with recording real standards of living for most people. So it's time to put this statistic to bed, and until it's been retired, at the very least, the media could be a little more subtle in how these somewhat shaky figures are reported. Our second story this week picks up on a recurring theme at Macrodose that finally seems to be cracking through into the mainstream reporting of economics and the environment. I'm talking about the truly incredible amounts of energy and raw material resources that our digital economy actually uses, and how its further expansion, driven on by increasingly unhinged AI hype, will gobble up still more. The hype was already a little unhinged, but now comes with a crazy number attached, $7 trillion, this being the figure that hype man-in-chief, Sam Altman of OpenAI, wants to raise for investment in so-called artificial intelligence. The figure's wild. To put it in perspective, the cost to the US of fighting World War II was about $5 trillion in today's money. Understandably, there's been some polite scepticism from the industry about whether it would even be possible to spend that much without completely transforming whole economies. Which is Altman's point. He's there to stoke up the buzz around AI, not so much to actually deliver on any of this stuff. It's not that we can't do incredible things with data processing, things which seem to have been lifted straight from science fiction, like conducting what appears to be an intelligible conversation with a computer. It's just that advancing beyond this point with the technologies we have is likely to prove difficult and costly for reasons we've discussed previously. On this point, I'd recommend the interview I did with Richard Jones on how current semiconductor technologies are reaching their limits and why it will be hard to replicate the rapid advances of the past in the years to come. We'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. Anyway, a major part of that cost are the energy requirements of data processing. Huge amounts of electricity are needed to keep the massive data centers that power the modern internet and AI humming along with the trillions of operations they perform. What's more, because this data processing generates heat, which will eventually stop those processors from working, they need even more electricity to keep cool. But it's when you start putting these demands for energy in perspective that the scale of what is happening becomes clear. Ireland has been promoting itself as a centre for data processing since the late 1990s or so. Google, for instance, opened its European headquarters there in 2004. And it's estimated today that there are 81 separate data centres located in Ireland. The International Energy Authority forecasts that by 2026, these data centres will consume one-third of Ireland's entire electricity output. So much, in fact, that the government there has begun to introduce restrictions on new data centres opening to try and limit their energy demands. Singapore, Germany and China already introducing limits on new builds. These demands are expected to soar. For example, semiconductor manufacturer Nvidia supplies the GPU chips that power modern AI. It's expecting to ship 1.5 million of these units per year by 2027. That annual installation would add an extra 84.5 terawatts of power demand annually, about the same as the whole of Belgium, if you're looking for a comparison. Even with very substantial improvements in efficiency, that's a lot of extra demand being loaded onto national energy systems that are already under strain. Blackouts and brownouts are getting worse in the US and across the developed world, as infrastructure that wasn't designed for either renewable supply or massively increased demand begins to falter. And these extra demands for energy don't arrive in a world where we can just sensibly and rationally allocate supplies where they are needed. Rather, it's in a world where constraints are leading to increased geopolitical competition. The US last year became the world's largest exporter of liquefied natural gas, LNG, used across the globe for generating electricity and for heating homes. The Biden administration has just barred the construction of more export facilities despite surging demand globally. They cited climate change concerns, which is fine, except that until this point, Biden's government was happy to oversee the US becoming the world's largest exporter of fossil fuels. It's probably better to look for a more cynical explanation. If the US knows electricity demand is going to skyrocket, pushing up demand for gas, and moreover, if the US wants to try and beat China, who are investing billions in new facilities in this data economy race, then control of gas exports becomes a major strategic issue. Gas not sold to China for data center use means gas that can be consumed in the US for data center use. Is there a better way around this? A better way to power the digital economy? Well, of course, one obvious solution is the massive expansion of renewables, with wind and solar energy being available across the globe. But for reasons I explore with economist Adrian Buller and geographer Brett Christophers in a forthcoming Macrodose roundtable, private capitalism isn't going to be able to deliver that on the scale we need. Our third and final story this week is another recurring theme, with the latest figures from the US showing that inflation has not come down as fast as the Federal Reserve and others anticipated. This has been something of a blow to the narrative that price rises were now under control after a nasty few years. Inflation in the US reached 3.1% in January, down from 3.4% in December, but that was sufficiently higher than expected as to set off alarm bells. It's been my position for a while that inflation will probably not be brought back under control in the US or in the developed world in general, at least not in the sense that this has come to mean, which is about 2% inflation or a little lower for a longer period of time. My argument is that since we are now in a more turbulent period in our collective history, not only will the big geopolitical surprises like Russia invading Ukraine continue to happen, but most fundamentally, the stable climate of the last 200 years of industrial capitalist growth no longer exists. The Anthropocene means more extreme weather events, like floods and droughts that destroy crops, or rising temperatures, which mean that the Panama Canal and the Rhine dry up and can't carry so many container ships, or even failures in overheating electricity supply systems, like hot French river water forcing nuclear power plant shutdowns. All of this means increased costs, and therefore rising and more volatile inflation. What's playing out at the moment are the extraordinary restrictions in two of the world's most important waterways, the Panama and Suez Canals, which between them carry about 17% of global trade. The Panama Canal, as we've covered, has been restricted to shipping for several months as a result of a major drought in Central America, meaning its locks can only carry smaller, lighter, and fewer vessels. These restrictions are now expected to last until at least April this year, and potentially longer. The Suez Canal, meanwhile, has been all but closed to most shipping as a result of attacks by Ansar Allah, commonly known as the Houthi movement, on ships entering the Red Sea. Attacks in response by a somewhat motley US-led coalition on targets in Yemen appear to have made no real difference here. Incidentally, the two are directly related. As we discussed previously, the Houthi attacks in the Red Sea are more consequential because the Panama Canal is closed. Management consultants McKinsey produced a report last month that spelled this out. With the Panama Canal restricted, many ships on the route from the western United States to Europe would ordinarily look to divert through the Suez Canal via the Pacific. McKinsey calculate that 496 ships would need to be diverted this way over the year, about 1 in 6 of all diverted ships. But obviously, if the Red Sea is essentially closed, that's not an option. The delays and the costs multiply, perhaps most immediately, as McKinsey suggests, affecting the price of US natural gas exports. This view of inflation is now starting to gain some traction. I wanted to flag an excellent new report produced by the think tank and campaign group Positive Money, along with the LSE's Grantham Research Institute, called Inflation as an Ecological Phenomenon. Written by David Barnes and Jordi Schroeder-Bosch, the title makes clear what the report is about, that we should be thinking about inflation and price rises as being substantially and increasingly affected by environmental factors. They call this climateflation, and the authors do a very good job of summarising what is an emerging field for research, demonstrating that the impacts of climate change on prices are real and likely to worsen, particularly in less developed countries. My one quibble might be that they focus heavily on the impacts on food prices, which are the most obvious route for climate change to drive inflation, but there are others, as the Panama Canal closure or the French nuclear power plant power downs in summer 2022 suggest. The report closes by proposing some ideas for what a different approach to economic policymaking might look like, including noting that the power of central banks to affect climateflation will be limited. It follows that we'll need to ditch the pretense of central bank independence and start being more prepared to use tools like price controls to guard against the sudden price surges that are already typical of climate-related shocks. There's probably no going back to what many still consider to be normal rates of inflation. We might hit them in passing, but we won't stay at 2% for very long. One thing we can be sure of, however, is that as long as central banks continue to ignore the new realities of the Anthropocene and carry on with business as usual, then the comparative economic stability of that old normal will slip ever further away. Thank you for listening to today's show. Macrodose is a Planet B production. If you enjoyed the show and you'd recommend it to friends, please consider leaving us a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts. You can find all our episodes, including our bonus interview content, on our Patreon at patreon.com/macrodose.